Okay, good morning, everyone. Our next argument coming up right now, pardon me as I gather my things over here, is on case number 78770, the Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services versus Brown. And I apologize. Here we go. Okay. And so is everybody ready to proceed?
I am, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, great. So I don't need to tell both of you how the clock works because you've been here enough that you both know. So we'll just go ahead and proceed. And for appellant Ms. Perry Stern, how much time would you like to reserve for rebuttal?
5 minutes, if I can.
Okay, sure. So as you know, the yellow light will come on and you'll hear the tone then, but it'll keep going. With that, you can begin.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Heidi Perry Stern on behalf of Southern Nevada Adult Mental Health Services. As this court has previously stated, a shared experience alone does not justify a class action. Rather, class plaintiffs must adequately demonstrate that their experience was similar, and most importantly, that it caused similar effects within the class. It was an abuse of discretion here for the district court both to certify and then later to refuse decertification. Plaintiffs did not even meet the minimum requirements for certification in 23A, let alone the predominance and superiority requirements in 23B, required to maintain their case as a class action. There are two cases that guide this court's analysis here, Walmart versus Dukes from the United States Supreme Court and Schuett versus Beezer from this court. With regard to commonality, as the Dukes court says, class members must suffer the same injury, not merely a violation of the same law, in order to satisfy commonality. In Dukes, that court found that class certification was not appropriate where there was a common question, which in that case was, why was I disfavored? But the answer to that question for each class member was not common. Likewise here, on appeal, plaintiffs have simplified their theory of the case to allege that they were all subject to a single act of negligence. That is, being provided a travel voucher for out-of-state travel without documentation of hospital-arranged plans for their housing and medical care once they arrived. But merely showing that a potential class member was provided a bus voucher for out-of-state travel does not provide an answer as to whether that class member suffered an injury. It doesn't provide an answer to whether that injury was common to the class, and it doesn't provide an answer to whether it was an act of Nevada Health Services that caused such injury. In addition, plaintiff's purportedly common question has little to do with the proof actually needed to prove each class member's claim of negligence. And that's assuming that this court even accepts that plaintiffs properly brought a claim of ordinary negligence against Nevada Health Services, which is not the case. There is a fundamental disconnect here between the class as defined by the district court and the class's legal claim of ordinary negligence. Negligence requires, as this court knows, a duty, a breach of that duty, causation of harm by breach of the duty, and damages. Plaintiffs presented their case regarding duty solely by medical experts. There was no presentation at trial of a duty for ordinary negligence. The standard of care presented at trial by two medical experts was an individualized medical standard. And Dr. Gupta, who was actually in charge of the discharge of Plaintiff Brown, also testified that he undertook a medical examination and discharge decision. But even if this court finds that the Szymborski non-medical standard of duty is applicable, which is to use reasonable care to avoid foreseeable harm, the foreseeability of harm still depends on the medical state of the individual and other individualized circumstances. Moving on to the requirement of breach, Breach necessarily follows from the nature of the duty, which here is centered on medical questions. And I think it's notable that the class definition itself requires individual medical inquiry. The class is specifically defined to require individualized medical analysis, whether or not each plaintiff was, quote, in need of mental health services at the time of discharge. This medical determination affects the question of breach. Likewise, causation requires an examination of individualized circumstances because each individual person is unique. And this is apparent from the trial testimony of the patients who did testify at trial regarding their experiences. Each one had a different situation. The court has outlined the analysis that it needs to follow in this case already in Schuett versus Beezer. And I would urge this court to find that a person discharged from a mental facility is at least as unique as the real property that this court examined in Schuett. The individualized nature of real property was of concern to this court in that case, and the individualized nature of the circumstances of the human plaintiffs here should provoke similar concern. As in Schuett, there's no reasonable basis on which to extrapolate to all class members a common injury or a cause of that injury as they pertain to one single individual. And again, I would direct this court to examine the testimony of Brown as compared to the testimony of other patients that testified at trial. And this is why claims for negligence in the medical context are not generally certified as class actions. There's a reason why this court is looking at cases that do not deal with medical treatment when it examines class action analysis. Generally, class actions are not for people who are receiving medical treatment because they, much more than real property, are unique.
Well, even if Ms. Stern, yes. Can I just clarify, yes. Justice Kadish in Carson City? So I just want to make sure I understand the distinction you're drawing or the facts that take this outside the class action permissibility. If, for example, if you have a defective product that you make and put out into the world and people all over, you know, something blows up on them when it shouldn't and they have their own injuries, if a class gets certified based on that, they're ultimately each going to have to show their own damages and their own injuries. And I don't think that necessarily takes it out of permissibility of a class action. So, you know, how is this different than the fact that each person may have their own unique damages?
Yes. And I think that the Beezer sort of responds to this, or the Schuett versus Beezer case, because it looks at what the injury is to see if the injury is common. So, for example, in a product liability case, or a data breach or a credit card fee case, every person there they've been injured in the same way. Here, some plaintiffs, per the class definition, would not have actually been injured at all if they asked to go to Los Angeles because their brother lives in Los Angeles. What Nevada Health Services was trying to do with its voucher policy was to provide the ability for that person to travel. So that person was actually not injured in that case, even though plaintiffs would argue they fit into the class definition. And certainly under the district court's understanding, they would fit into that class definition. So that's one answer to your question. But there's another answer, which comes later in the case, which is the court had to look at whether plaintiffs should be able to maintain their class action. And that required an examination of whether common questions predominated. And that's obviously a slightly different analysis than whether there were common questions at all. And that question for predominance is, are the issues capable of resolution through generalized proof more substantial than the issues subject to individualized proof? And I do think this really gets to the heart of your question, because here, the individualized questions of plaintiffs' mental health and capabilities, their consent, their desire to go out of state, their connections with the out-of-state location, all of those questions are vastly more important than the purportedly common question of whether plaintiff received a voucher for out-of-state travel and a taxi ride to the bus station. So, in short, the question of whether being provided an out-of-state travel voucher caused harm to any particular class member actually cannot be resolved by generalized proof. And that is the standard that plaintiffs needed to meet and failed to meet when the court refused to decertify. And that was an abuse of discretion.
I have a question. This is Justice Pickering in Las Vegas. The district court certification order doesn't just certify the class based on the person being discharged and given money or and a bus ticket with Greyhound. Subparagraph B says, and without documentation or arrangements for them to be met upon arrival and or directed to facilities at which shelter and or continuation of care could be obtained. So it wasn't, your analogy of somebody going to their brother's house in Los Angeles isn't quite perfect, because if the brother was meeting them at the Greyhound bus station in Los Angeles, they would be outside by this definition, would they not?
It depends on the documentation, I believe. And that's actually one of the problems with the way the class was defined, is that subsection, it's pretty confusing who fits into the class and who doesn't, because it's unclear whether that section B requires a very individualized determination of circumstances or whether it requires no documentation of anything, or whether it's okay if there's partial documentation. And if this court looks to the record that plaintiffs themselves provided with regard to the discharge of the various patients who testified at trial and the ones who were examined as part of the state and federal studies, you'll see that each patient had a slightly different form of documentation. And it's quite unclear. In fact, the district court itself anticipated many trials on that very issue. And in its order, at the end of trial, said that the parties needed to find a neutral master, basically, to adjudicate who belongs in the class. Because, and the reason for that, he doesn't say this, but the reason for it is because there's so many individualized questions that the parties are not going to agree on. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. I feel like the rest of our arguments were well covered in our briefing. So thank you.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Polzenberg, are you arguing today?
I am.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Yes, a lot of the arguments haven't been presented today, so let's concentrate on the ones that were. You know, what happened here is despicable. It is hard to imagine that the state of Nevada would avoid the proper way to treat their disabled citizens by putting them on buses and sending them out to 48 other states. And the state actually admitted that the purpose of this policy was to conserve the resources of Nevada. And it's almost as bad, the arguments that we have on appeal, for the state again to be trying to avoid its responsibility. One of the arguments has to do with class. One of them has to do with whether ordinary negligence was pleaded. The general didn't argue that today. I won't go into it much, but that's an issue that they waived. But they also waived their predominance argument. So, yeah, certification, Chute versus Beezer is pretty clear that there are two different standards, the standards under 23A and the standard in a money damages case under 23B3. And the problem in Chute versus Beezer was you had 200 homes who were damaged by 200 different construction defects. There was no common issue in this case. Here the definition makes clear, the definition of the class makes clear that we're talking about mental health patients who were admitted and subsequently discharged, and A, upon discharge, were put on a bus And B, after upon discharge, there is no documentation that the arrangements were made for them to be met or arrangements for aftercare in the new destination. That's a very easy formula, a very easy definition. In fact, Judge Denton made clear he was giving the state in the findings of fact and conclusions of law an order 15 days to go through the 653 cases and go through and see which ones had documentation and which ones didn't. And yes, as is typical in a class action, if there's a dispute whether somebody actually meets the definition, we can resolve that. This case is really no different. The classic case I kept bringing up in the Beezer argument was the fraudulent taxi cab beater. All you have to do to certify the class is say anybody who was in a cab and paid the meter amount on a fraudulent meter. Now, would there be some fact-finding? Sometimes, yes, to see if somebody actually was in such a cab. That doesn't create an individualized issue. Now, Justice Kadish, you raised a great example. What if it's a products case and there are common issues of liability, but different issues of causation and damages? In those circumstances, we'd still have commonality. Would we need mini groups or trials in a joinder action for each one of those? Well, that issue's waived here because the state stipulated that every member of the class would get the same damages Mr. Brown got. And that's what I'm talking
about. Mr. Polzenberg, if I might, this is Justice Herndon in Carson City. I'm concerned about, and I'll just use the acronym SNAMS for brevity's sake, I'm concerned about how SNAMS is even a party at the time of trial. Plaintiffs appear to have been very specific in their pleading about naming all defendants and or individual defendants in the various causes of action. They specifically seem to have excluded SNAMS in the causes of action for negligence and negligence per se. The court found that SNAMS was only a party to the medical malpractice and civil conspiracy claims and then dismissed those on summary judgment, yet somehow SNAMS is still left to defend itself at trial, having been dismissed from the only claims that were lodged against them. How can that lie?
Let me explain, too. Yeah, on the second cause of action, which was for medical malpractice, they were not individually named there either. What we did in our pleadings was, on the first cause of action, the second and the third, we listed the individual actors, the administrator, the three doctors. And then in later paragraph, for example, 48, and we talk about that on the first cause of action for negligence, and then say defendants cause these damages. So it really, the mental health services was named in its capacity of being vicariously liable. So it was named that way, too, in the medical malpractice cause of action. So what happened is, at the end, we get a judgment against the administrator and the mental health services as being vicariously liable for her actions. And the judgment is originally entered against both of them. Now, under Nevada law, not only was the jury instructed that there is vicarious liability for the employer, and a hospital is differently vicariously liable for its own employees, like the administrator, from how it would be for contractors, like the doctors. But the judgment went in against both of those. And under Nevada law, there's an express statute in Nevada that the state must pay for any damage against an individual actor in her official capacity. But then after trial, and so I have an easy argument right there on the judgment. On the pleadings, on everything that went on during the trial, and on the judgment that was entered, the state is liable vicariously for the administrator, the implementation and administration of this policy of putting people on buses.
But don't they have to plead that they're seeking vicarious liability against them?
No, I think all we have to do is plead that they're liable. And I do think that we, Judge Denton said that we did plead that. He said we did it two ways. Look at, for example, in paragraph 54, where it doesn't just list the four defendants individually named in that cause of action. It says defendants, plural, all of them. You won't find an allegation against the mental health services that isn't vicarious.
So what do I do with paragraph 48 that specifically says who the claim is asserted on behalf of and who it's asserted against?
It says it's asserted directed toward on the money damages claim. But in paragraph 54, it talks about defendants generally. And Judge Denton said he understood that all the way through the case. It's in our pretrial conference. So there was no dispute here that we were suing in ordinary negligence. We were not principally going under professional negligence. Professional negligence has become a big issue in Nevada. Make that bigger. Because there's so many protections for malpractice. There's a different statute of limitation. There's a different pleadings requirement. There's a cap on damages. So now hospitals all want to fall under those protections. And this court's been good in a series of cases in pointing out when it applies and when it doesn't apply. Now, I'll tell you, I was the general counsel of a hospital, and there's an awful lot a hospital does that isn't covered under Chapter 41A. I think it's important to note, even when it says professional negligence in Chapter 41A, that's a term of art. And what it's not talking about is any negligence by any professional. It must be by a provider of health services. And that's defined in the next section as being very specific mental or dental capacities. So the statute doesn't apply here. And when they moved for JNOV, they actually affirmatively argued from the beginning, they say, plaintiff's allegations against Chelsea Scalagna and against her state employer have been indistinguishable. They themselves argue this in getting the administrator out of the judgment. So not only have they waived it, they've essentially, by seeking this relief and getting it from the district court under judicial estoppel, they've guaranteed this judgment in their vicariously liable capacity. And the jury was instructed on vicariously liable. And Dr. Gupta made the distinction between these two areas. He says, I, as a treater, I use my medical judgment in making the decision whether to discharge. Everything after that is administrative. So we're not talking about individual issues of why they are discharged. The definition is they have to be discharged. And so we're not looking into did they really need medical services, although that language is used. But it's only used in the context of having been admitted and subsequently discharged.
Mr. Polzenberg, can I just follow up on that then? It's my understanding that your client presented two different experts at the time of trial to talk about the standard of care at the time of discharge. So, and those were apparently medical people. So how do you reconcile that with the argument that this isn't about medical negligence?
It isn't about medical negligence. What actually goes on during a discharge isn't the type of work that needs to be done by a doctor. One of our experts was an MD psychiatrist, but the other one was a PhD psychologist. And so they were necessary not only to show the standard of care, but also to show the damages that would result in the exacerbation of a schizophrenic patient. So this court has said in Williams versus District Court, you don't have to have a specific type of expert to talk about another expert's duties and breach of duties if that person is knowledgeable. So an MD could talk about what the duties are of the hospital generally. An MD could talk about what the social workers should have done. And those were the areas where they were the breaches. From this beginning of the case, this was a case about putting people on buses.
Are the requirements for documentation and hospital records governed by medical standards?
They're governed by statutes in the state and federal. And that's why we, but some of the other statutes that apply here, NRS 433A says that a facility has the duty to discharge someone back to the county where they had resided. And that's the negligence per se procedure.
Oh, all right. I understand, and I apologize, but I want to, I'm looking at the class action definition again and its focus and requirement, which you alluded to earlier, that it requires that not only that they have been discharged to a taxi to the bus terminal, but that they didn't have any documentation in their records of these arrangements for follow-up care to be met on arrival and all those things. So presumably that's part of the breach of duty that you're alleging by SNAMS, is that they didn't document
yes.
these things in their records. So my question is, isn't a failure to document things in hospital records a medical question that relies on medical standards?
I don't think it relies on medical standards. Just as this court has said, not everything a hospital does is a breach of professional responsibility.
Right.
We argued for something even more than what Judge Denton did. I think Judge Denton took a conservative approach. He did so in his injunction as well. Instead of enjoining the state from putting people on buses, he enjoined them for putting people on buses without the proper documentation. But even the administrator argued, from an administrator's standpoint, not from a physician standpoint, that you have to document these things, or if it isn't documented, it didn't happen.
Mr. Polzenberg.
So the lack of documentation simply proves my first point, that they were being put on Greyhound buses sent to places where they had no provision for their follow-up. And a social worker could tell you that that was necessary.
Mr. Polzenberg, this is Justice Herndon.
It
would seem, to dovetail slightly onto what Justice Kadish was asking about, it would seem that your presentation at trial with the medical experts talking about standard of care was a recognition that this is something that jurors are not going to commonly understand without the assistance of those medical experts. And doesn't that make it a medical malpractice claim?
No, it doesn't. The what you need for any time you bring in an expert, it's so that you can tell the jury about something that's not in their ordinary knowledge and experience. I mean, the first case I ever did at trial had to do with a mechanic not putting a cotter pin on the wheel of a dune buggy. So I had an expert who said, you need to put the cotter pin in because not everybody knows. A doctor coming in and saying, this is the way a hospital works because you weren't the general counsel of a hospital, simply is filling in the jury on what the requirements are. We could have done it just by citing the federal and state statutes and regulations. But that doesn't make for a great jury presentation. But that's different from the 41A100 requirements of where you need proof.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Ms. Stern?
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the most disturbing to me and confusing aspects of this case as I reviewed the record, and I've reviewed a lot of records, was the disservice that plaintiff's attorneys did to Mr. Brown by not pleading properly, in the initial pleading, not including an affidavit to support a medical malpractice claim, by not proving an ordinary negligence claim, by at trial not presenting evidence of that negligence claim, and then on appeal, claiming that all along they had done so. I take issue with Mr. Polzenberg's characterization of Nevada Health Services trying to get away with something here. There certainly may be cases where Nevada Health Services did not act in the best manner possible towards one of their patients. And that may have involved giving that person a voucher to travel out of state. In fact, Mr. Brown himself may have an individual claim but it's not a class. And in this case, that claim for Mr. Brown was neither pled, no discovery was done on it, because Nevada Health Services had no opportunity to assert any defenses to it because it wasn't pled. Ultimately,
What are you saying wasn't pled?
The ordinary negligence claim. I'm sorry for the confusion. Okay. The ordinary negligence claim that they're now relying on for their judgment. Because they can't rely on their Med Mal or professional negligence claim because of the statute of limitations. But in any case, that problem with this case that Judge Herndon so described so well requires a judgment in favor of Nevada Health Services. And as this court knows, the cases that we've been looking towards, the Szymborski case and the DeBoer case, those cases demonstrate that an individual can bring one of these types of claims. There are non-medical aspects of discharge. Unfortunately, in this case, at this trial, the only testimony with regard to discharge was related to the medical decision. I would direct this court to look at Dr. Gupta's testimony.
But Ms. Stern, I'm sorry to interrupt you. This is such a challenging format. They're also arguing a negligence per se claim as far as what's required here. And why cannot the negligence per se doctrine have the duty established through that statute?
Yeah, and that's a fairly easy question, Your Honor. The statute is NRS 433A.400, and it specifically requires a medical determination. It specifically it says, if you look at the plain language in subsection 1, there needs to be a determination of medical or surgical disability in that case. And I would just close by urging this court to, at the very least, decertify the class. And I do believe that that this case requires a judgment in favor of Nevada Health Services. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Thanks, counsel, for your briefing and arguments on this interesting case. We'll be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.